Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When columnist and essayist Stanley Crouch surveys American culture, he sees a problem. He sees black music moguls celebrating a hip-hop gangland of larger-than-life thugs and hussies. He sees white writers fashioning an American fiction devoid of race and color, blacks turning their backs on education, whites projecting a primitive tribalism on blacks, both races riding a rocket of profit and prejudice down to the lowest common denominators of American culture. He sees America yearning to be what it's not. Americans afraid to be who they are. It's a desperate search for a false ideal, he says, for a grasp at cultural authenticity that's taken American culture, black and white, straight into a hollow, helpless, hopeless world of artificiality. And Stanley Crouch says, let's stop. What's at stake, he says, is nothing less than you, the American individual, and American civilization. Tonight on Point, essayist Stanley Crouch on American culture and American authenticity. Now, joining me from New York City is Stanley Crouch, columnist for the New York Daily News, jazz critic, novelist, and television commentator. He's artistic consultant at New York's Lincoln Center and co-founder with Wynton Marsalis of the department known as Jazz at Lincoln Center. He's author of many books, including Notes of a Hanging Judge and Don't the Moon Look Awesome. His latest collection is The Artificial White Man, Essays on Authenticity. Stanley Crouch, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So tell us straight off, we're dying to know, what is the artificial white man?
Oh, well, that's a guy named David Shields, or it's about him in an essay that's the title essay of the book, which is a very close reading of a book that he wrote about the Seattle Supersonics, in which he seemed to present himself in a kind of what I consider like an artificial white everyman. When in his earlier books he didn't do that, and I thought that he made some very very disturbing uses of the black basketball players whom he was writing about, because he wrote about a season of the Seattle Supersonics, and he observed a number of things about the players and the interplay between the players and the white fans and so on. But he seemed to be stuck on a certain kind of a rudeness and an obnoxiousness that the players had towards the whites, and he seemed to get some kind of joy out of people mindlessly breaking the rules.
So there's the specific story, David Shields, his book Black Planet, you say, and kind of living vicariously through this sort of on-the-court persona of the black NBA players. But you've made it the whole title of your book. You're giving a kind of bigger metaphorical conceptual meaning as well here. You're thinking a lot about authenticity. We see Stanley Crouch. At that level, what's the artificiality you're talking about? What's the artificial white man there?
Well, the first thing is that he, in his earlier books, he was very specific about being a Jewish guy and looked at different things in Hollywood and American culture from the perspective of a guy who had grown up in basically the upper middle class, Jewish upper middle class. And I thought that he kind of threw that out the window, even though he makes mention of it in his book Black Planet. But he doesn't really investigate it. And I think he puts on the sheep's clothing of the white everyman that I don't think is real. In other words, he's neither as close to the regular white people nor as far away from the black people as he presents himself in the essay. And I don't think that he asks a number of questions there would be much more, that would reflect much deeper thought about the situation that he sees taking place between the basketball players and the white fans.
Stanley Crouch, you've got a really provocative collection of essays here. You've got all sorts of subjects. We go from Quentin Tarantino and Ernest Hemingway to William Faulkner and Saul Bellow, Duke Ellington. You touch down on the culture from many angles, but this issue of authenticity runs through the whole collection. You paint the importance of it in very large terms. You say, I truly believe that the American future is the future of the planet at large. But I'm trying to get a handle on what it is about authenticity that's got your attention. Many Americans say that they want to be authentic. They're searching for authenticity. I read you as being critical of that search for authenticity itself. Why?
Well, I'm critical of a search for a kind of an ersatz authenticity and an authenticity that tends to be that often is supposedly primitive and often is supposedly hostile to civilized values, and that is supposedly most real when it's most ignorant, most eloquent when it's most inarticulate, that these kinds of things that rise up out of the world of rock and out of rap, and that have this idea that the further removed from what we would call refinement of an individual or an ethnic group is, the realer that the person is supposed to be. And I don't buy that.
You bemoan the loss of a high culture, and you portray blacks and whites of getting caught in a kind of world where African-Americans are seen in this low culture role as a sort of, I don't know, it's like the contemporary heir of the noble savage.
That's right. You called it. That's exactly correct. It's like noble savage 101. 21st century.
But this time, instead of loincloths and horses, bows and arrows, it's hip hop garb and bling bling and the vulgarity of rap.
Yeah, and when you look at the way these people are rendered on MTV and VH1 and these different things, they're rendered as buffoons.
You call them neo sambos, the new minstrels. That's pretty sharp stuff.
Yeah. Well, have you looked at it?
Yes, I have.
Well, what does it look like to you?
Well, you know, I'm taking your word for it. But you know, there's also a kind of lineage here to hip hop. I mean, it was presented to be a kind of effort to get close to the street, to get close to reality, keeping it real. Are you saying it was once worthy and fell low, or it's just low, low, low? Forget it.
No, well, the first thing is as I point out in the long essay about Quentin Tarantino,
who you adore, who you idolize.
Yeah, I think he's a very good, great artist. I think, but the thing is that he's very clear in his work that he doesn't celebrate guys who sell guns. He doesn't celebrate drug dealers.
He sure got a lot of both in his movies.
Yes, but they're never the good guys. He doesn't pretend that, you know, if you look at Jackie Brown, the guy that Sam Jackson plays, the gun dealer, he's the villain. He's not the hero. He's the villain. Sam Greer is the hero, and so the thing I'm saying is that he shows these people, it seems to me, as what they actually are. They may have a kind of a cute rhetoric, or they may have a slight kind of charm, but basically they're menaces to society. And he always renders them as that.
And Quentin Tarantino leaves no doubt about that, though there's still sort of the glory of all that blood flying. But what is it that you see then in rep more generally, what's the presentation and who's pushing it? Black Americans or white or both?
Well, the first thing is, Russell Simmons often says that 4 out of 5 rap recordings are sold in the suburbs. So the audience, so the largest audience for rap recordings is a white audience.
You talk about natives or white males going on audio safari with natives from the urban jungle.
Yeah, that's what I call the audio safari. You don't have to get inoculated. You don't have to get gun bearers. You don't have to have mosquito net.
And what's going on in that relationship? What's going on with the black performers and their bosses? What's going on with the white buyers?
Well, the reason why I call it the new minstrelsy is because they're doing exactly the same thing that the old minstrels did, which is that they are perpetuating an image of themselves as inferior that makes their value as entertainment is that they project themselves as these inferior, subhuman, dangerous, decadent, tasteless, sluttish individuals.
And when you talk about authenticity, are these performers in their own minds reaching for authenticity here, or is this a send up?
No, is it a send up? A commodity. See, it's like I saw this guy, Luther Campbell, the guy from Two Live Crew.
Yep.
I saw him on television some years ago, and he said, well, you know, this stuff is controversial, because you know controversy sells in the suburbs. So the thing was, these people aren't artists, they're entertainers. They're not making artistic statements. They're producing a product that they know has commercial potential, and they're selling this barbaric attitude of black young men as thugs and black young women as sluts.
But that's a deliberate kind of a performance, you're saying. Are they lost in that performance themselves? Have they lost touch with the authenticity?
Well, first thing is, you know that they don't live in these communities. As soon as they get some money, they get the hell out of there. So they're not living in the communities where the gang wars and all that stuff go on. They're not there. They're up in the Hollywood Hills or somewhere else, away from that.
And the white purchasers, what's their role in all this?
Well, I said that's their trip to the jungle.
Okay, we got it. So you got the neo-sambo kind of role being played, or the new minstrelsy on one side,
right.
The audio safari on the other, and in the midst of all this, help me again here, Stanley Crouch. Do you want Americans to look for authenticity or to forget about the idea of authenticity?
No, but you see, that's a canned authenticity. That's a canned authenticity. The thing is that what makes you authentic is what you turn out to be, right? That is to say, you can't, what they call signifiers or cultural signifiers, mm-hmm. things that tell you one way or another what someone is or is not. Those things can be very limiting visions of what an individual is. I mean, the point of American life is supposed to be the pursuit of individual freedom that does not infringe upon the freedom of other people. And if a black kid from the lower class feels that he or she, in order to be authentic, should not be a good student, there are a number of things that they shouldn't do in order to be authentic, then that's not authenticity. That's an acceptance of a number of limitations. And what I'm trying to say is that we don't need to have any kind of limited vision of authenticity about anybody, whether they're black people or white people or Hispanics or anybody else. That the biggest, broadest possible vision of what their human possibility is what they should be shooting for.
Stanley Kress, we're running alongside your train here. We're looking to figure it out. We're glad you're with us tonight. We've got to take a short break here. I'm talking with essayist, author, columnist for the New York Daily News, Stanley Crouch. His new book is The Artificial White Man, Essays on Authenticity. Listeners, you can join us. Has black popular culture in the rap music boom taken the low road in a search for authenticity or big bucks? Has white popular culture cheered on the descent and gone with it? Have Americans become lost in an obsession with authenticity? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the obsessions and blind spots of American culture today. Our guest is Stanley Crouch. He's author of the new book, The Artificial White Man, Essays on Authenticity. You can join this conversation. Has the American search for authenticity become a race to the bottom in American culture? And if it has, why? Do you see rap stars as the new minstrels, as neo-sambos, and white guys? Has Stanley Crouch got your number? Is he on to you here? Black guys, are you on board with Crouch's analysis, or do you see the world another way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'm trying to understand what Stanley's talking about.
We're working it.
Okay, well, I'm trying to get a distinction that's useful, and I'm thinking that maybe what Stanley, and I'm going to ask Stanley if what you mean by authenticity would be clarified by the opposite, which I think would be deception. That what's opposite from authenticity is deception. The will or the effort to deceive. And I think the rub is that to be human, I think, what really distinguishes human beings is that they're the animals that do deceive.
They put on all kinds of masks.
Oh, yeah. That's what to be human is, to deceive.
So good sense.
Is what you mean by authenticity something that's opposite from the willful deception?
Stanley Crouch, what do you mean by authenticity?
Well, are you
for it or against it?
Well, the first thing is, like I was saying, is that I don't believe in a narrow, imposed vision of authenticity. I mean, what we're really talking about is the kind of authenticity, if you will, that has developed in which, for instance, a person like Biggie Smalls, for instance, would be seen as more authentic than, say, someone like Andrew Young, who was a major figure in the civil rights movement, was the ambassador to the UN, was the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia.
And you're saying that's backwards?
Yeah. Yeah, when we talk, when these people talk about being authentic or keeping it real or something, then Chris Rock said it very simply on one of mm-hmm. his shows called Bring the Pain. He said, keeping it real, real dumb.
Real dumb.
Right. And I don't buy that.
But
what I'm saying is that's a very narrow idea of being authentic, and it has very low expectations, and it has very, very low aspirations.
Our caller Sam says human race, the species, is all about putting on masks.
Oh, the problem, mask, I mean, of course, I mean, you know, Ralph Ellison has written extensively about that.
Mm.
But the point is, if both the viewer and the performer are aware that this is a mask, that's one thing. But when this kind of mask is thought to be the real person, and if people are misled into believing that's the way they should be, then we're talking about a form of decadence in the culture.
Are you giving us the kind of Bill Cosby critique of black culture and then whacking whites as well here? Is that where you're headed, Stanley?
Well, the first thing is, it's not a matter of whacking anybody. It's a question of do we, I mean, the first thing is this: if you take, which it's just a simple thing, the vision that comes out of this material that we're talking about advocates a kind of a willful ignorance, an obsession with surfaces, terrible taste, and thuggish and sluttish behavior.
Bogus authenticity that just goes low.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm saying.
And you're saying enough of that, and everybody's kind of in on the game.
Let's get out of that.
Let's get another call. Judith is calling from East Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Judith. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just going to have one comment, was that I believe teenagers nowadays, they don't have goals. They don't have culture behind them, and they try to copy others. And the only thing they have on TV is the rap and the black music. And unfortunately, I think that they are trying to copy that culture and then trying to make it their own.
Why do you say that, Judith? What's your evidence of that?
I have an 18-year-old son who was raised in a white home, and I never spoke like he does. I don't understand him.
What do you mean? How does he speak?
He says, the crib. He says, when somebody come by and pick me up, he says something totally different. I have to say to him sometimes, speak English with me, please.
You mean he's doing a kind of black rap vernacular or accent even?
Exactly. And I have to constantly remind him to speak English with me at home.
Is that rare, or are his friends in on it? Black friends, white friends?
All of his friends are on in it. They speak on the phone like that. They type on when they're IMing. Sometimes he IMs me at work, and he doesn't spell any of the words out. And I'm spelling all of the words out, and I say to him, I don't know what you mean by, three letters out of the whole world.
Well, IMing may take us into another thing entirely, but Judith, we've got it. Stanley Crouch, Judith's son, is white. He talks black popular culture. Is this the sincerest form of admiration or something else?
Well, I mean, it might be, but again, all of this is all backward, barbaric stuff, and it's not. I mean, and the thing is, it's not a matter of trying to say that we should expect extremely refined decisions and extremely refined taste, because the definition of an American teenager is a tasteless person anyway. But the question that I'm raising is that, you see, the rap image is like for the white kid in the suburbs, that's the new version of green hair. Or that's what that is to them. In other words, they're not gonna go out and get guns. They're not necessarily going to walk out of school. They're not necessarily going to believe that the two alternatives that they have in life are going into the NBA or becoming a rap star. That's not necessarily what they're going to do.
But you're not presenting this, Stanley Crouch, as a kind of issue of a fashion statement. You're presenting it as a cultural crisis.
It is a cultural crisis, but because it accepts the lowest version of a community as the most authentic and realist version. In other words, when we talk about this kind of like keeping it real thing, then those are the kinds of people who said when the Cosby Show was on television that those weren't real black people.
Because they were too bourgeois, too middle class.
Yeah, right. She's a lawyer. He's a gynecologist. Said no, kids go to college. No, those aren't real black people. Real black people are people who cannot speak the English language or who live in the projects, etc. That those are the only black people who are real, and that's all just a lie.
You're trying to carve out some space even for that Cosby Show model. Khalil's calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Khalil. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. How is everybody?
We're great. What's on your mind, Khalil?
The thing is, I think that, like, a lot of what the topic is being talked about, I think everybody's really missing the point. The whole, like, rap music in general is not just all negative. Like, you also have your Kanye West, you also have your Talib Kweli's, and you also have other rappers out there that are projecting a more positive image. I agree with them as fact that the buffoonery that is going on TV, but you gotta think, too, then why is Clear Channel and why is all these corporations or, you know, these record labels putting that stuff on there.
Well, they're making money, but Stanley Crouch says overall it's a kind of dragging down of culture, dragging down of black people and white people. You say no, Khalil?
Right, right. I say I agree in some aspects as far as what's being put out there commercially today, but I also there are also like rappers out here that are really, really tired and fed up on what's on TV, and there are rappers that are out here that are saying like, yeah, you know, we agree with this, you know, as this is being negative and this is not really accurately portraying black culture, because, you know, for every person that's holding a cup with gold teeth dancing around like a fool, there's also people with intelligent art like Kanye West. Like Kanye West had like a single, Jesus Walks, which was a very positive rap song.
Stanley Crouch, what do you say to Khalil?
Well, I mean, you know, I've met those guys, and those are not the people I'm talking about. Firstly, they're not the people I'm talking about. Secondarily, the person who sold 6 million CDs last year was 50 Cent. It wasn't Khalil.
Not Kanye West. Mm-hmm.
They don't sell like that. And they don't get projected like that. Now the thing is that right now, Essence Magazine has started a campaign called Take the Music Back, in which they're protesting these images of black women that you get in these videos. And they're getting, you know, anybody who wants to look at it, go to essence.com on the internet, and you can see that there's an enormous body of people, male and female, who see this same problem that I'm talking about, that recognize that there's, as Shakespeare said, something rotten in Denmark.
You're saying a big black female audience with Essence Magazine pushing back against this. Stanley Crouch, stand by. Khalil, thanks for your call. I want to turn to Los Angeles for a minute. We're joined from there by Earl Ofari Hutchinson. He's an author, and you know Earl, author, political analyst, author of many books, including The Assassination of the Black Male Image, publisher of the Hutchinson Report newsletter, weekly online public issues publication. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, always a pleasure. Thank you.
So
and my good friend Stanley Crouch. How you doing, Stanley?
Hey, how you doing, Earl?
All right.
So here's Stanley Crouch. He's going after this presentation of authenticity. He says it ends up degrading. It ends up artificial on all sides. And the country's got to get out of it, black and white. Do you see it as a big trap on the cultural leg here?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, you know, Stan and I, we've had some philosophical disagreements on many issues, but on one issue, I think we stand united on. I've written the book, The Assassination of the Black Male Image, which you've referenced in the beginning, also Beyond OJ, Race, Sex, and Class Lessons for America, and also my latest, A Crisis in Black and Black. In each one of those chapters, I talk about this cultural crisis that we have within black America, and especially among young African-American males. When we say the assassination of the black male image, you know, I only just talk about, not only talk about white America and the media and so forth, but I also talk about how blacks assassinate their own image. I have a whole chapter on the rap culture and so forth, which looks at that, comedians, rappers, and so forth, but also I like what the previous caller said. There is a cautionary note here. I think he's absolutely correct. Yes, while we do have to have the cultural criticism, and even more than that, a very pointed the finger at many of the young rappers that do, in fact, play to all the stereotypes, that do, in fact, really dig their own cultural grave and project this image of negativity and destruction out to the greater audience. I think at the same time, there's still room to recognize there is a wide body of young people that don't buy into that, that are trying to, in fact, move away from that, that are, in fact, to live up to some decent standards and morality, and are, in fact, trying to do some things to improve the community. So, you know, I think sometimes there's got to be a balance to this, because there is a danger. Sometimes if we go too far overboard, then we also are guilty sometimes of reinforcing our own stereotypes about them by giving the impression that all, most, or many young African-American males and females fit into that decadent, degenerate, destructive kind of image.
So was the Cosby Show really more authentic, as Stanley Crouch would have it?
Well, again, authenticity is really very elastic. Would you say that the young African-American male that's a Rhodes Scholar, that in fact is achieving in school, that goes on to have a very good career in business or the professions, college graduate, would you say that he or she is less authentic than, say, the thug and the gangbanger out there,
I
or
hear
someone
you.
In
mm-hmm.
between?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying that authenticity is almost like beauty. Sometimes it's in the eye of the beholder.
Stanley Crouch, historically there's been a kind of power relationship. And the minstrels were minstrels for a reason. It was a way to make money, and they didn't have many. Well, how do you see the power relationship in this authenticity, artificiality formula that you're laying out here? Are young black Americans doing this deliberately? Are they being pushed to it by white America? Is it a racial issue, a power issue, or not?
Well, the first thing is it's complex, and like the way and you know, an artificial white man. I discuss these things in detail and in very complexly because, for instance, you have streams of lower class black culture, so called street culture, that are as influenced by the Godfather I and Godfather II and Scarface as they are and Brian De Palma's Scarface as they are anything so called black. You know?
Yeah.
I mean that's part of the complexity of what I'm trying to talk about in the artificial white man, is that it's not just that, you know, you've got these black people over here and you've got this big wall between them and the rest of America.
But that, in general, you celebrate. I mean, as I read you anyway, you say this cultural miscegenation, this sort of integration of cultures is the great American project, so why not?
Oh, yeah, but you see, the only thing I'm saying, and going back to what Hutchinson is saying, is that the first thing is we can't limit the vision of a group of people on of any ethnic group this lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. If we want to find the real one of them, whomever that is, because what we're saying, if we accept what the popular rap image, 50 Cent and those kind of people say, then that would be like taking the idea, that would be like some redneck white guy is a more authentic white guy than Bill Clinton or than some
it's been said. You know, Earl Farr Hutchinson, we just got you for half a minute more. What do you think of this? Here we are a century after the minstrel shows and more. Is it weird that we're still talking about blacks being minstrels?
No, because you said something a little bit earlier when you asked Stanley. You said, what is it? Is it race? Is it power? Is it money? You know, what's fueling this thing? What's driving this? I say all of the above. And then one other thing, it almost has a life of its own. Let's face it, when you talk about buck dancing, minstrels, and grinning, and cooning, and all of that, something we thought was a product of a century or more past, and we still see it kind of reemerging today. It's fed by all of these things, and also it takes on a life of its own when the participants themselves drive it and feed it because they find, guess what, they can make money, they can get attention, and they can get the spotlight of America on them.
Earl Farr Hutchinson, author of The Assassination of the Black Male Image, thanks for being with us tonight from L.A. We're talking with Stanley Crouch, author of The Artificial White Man. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight, Stanley Crouch, essayist, columnist, author. His new book is The Artificial White Man, Essays on Authenticity. Stephen's calling from New York City. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I guess I don't really accept the thesis that Stanley Crouch is putting forward that these pop culture examples are the new minstrelry. I mean, we have a lot of other examples of people out there. Jamie Foxx, Denzel Washington, fully respected, you know, Academy Award nominees. And pop culture produced by any group, the majority of it is junk anyway, and it's not different for people of any race. But what really incensed me was, and I think that shows how out of touch Stanley Crouch is, was his really surprising categorical insult of teenagers, calling them just the definition of a teenager is a tasteless person. You know, how dismissive and rude is that? I'm really shocked. You know, it just shows that he's not really interested in engaging, I think, with younger people.
Because if he were, he would see that the
insult them to begin with.
But he'd see the inherent an inherent value in the rap music that they're bopping to.
Well, I mean, you know, there's some of it's junk, some of it's not. You know,
yep.
It's just true of any pop culture situation. A lot of it is lowest common denominator, but I don't see why that's a particular crisis for you know African Americans more than white people or Latinos or anything. I mean, like a lot of stuff. I don't like what I see at the top of the charts of the music or the box office or whatever. I mean, that's not interesting, but. You know, there is a variety of expression that exists out there in the world.
There's a lot. Stephen, you're hot. Let me ask you this. What about the presentation of white folk people who are into this as kind of using it as an antidote to their own empty whiteness, in the words of the Weekly Standard, a kind of vapid negrophilia?
I'm not sure that that's actually. I mean, there's been vapid. I mean, I'm not going to use that word. But that's not a new phenomenon, right? I mean, I think there's been a historically very bad fetishization, let's say, you know, for all the wrong reasons. Over, you know, through, you know, Tom, you can see that. That was true. You know, enslaved it.
Look almost anywhere you like. Sure, there's a long tradition there. Stephen, we're almost out of time, but thanks for your call. Stanley Crouch, how about it? Are you insulting teenage America by calling the whole thing tasteless?
Well, the first thing is, I have friends who are teenagers, and I mean,
some of your best friends?
My daughter's in her 20s now, but I knew her when she was a teenager. And there were a number of things that, I mean, kids are just kids. You know, they don't have refined taste.
So that's not new under the sun. That's
not an insult to kids. They don't have refined taste.
Yeah, but you've got a kind of apocalyptic version of it here.
You know, but the thing is, it's not. The first thing is, the arguments in Artificial White Man are not simple arguments.
Granted.
Stated. They're not simply argued.
Mm-hmm.
They're a complex set of arguments about films. About books, about, you know, and about visions, iconic icons that rise out of these different things.
Amen. No question. We've just got a minute left. Where should Americans look for that authentic self? Is that the mission, to find authenticity?
Well, I think it's to not be taken down by decoys, as an earlier caller said. But I think if your listeners pick up the Artificial White Man, I think they'll be able to figure it out.
And do you see the culture turning a corner here, or are we headed for?
Oh, we're not going down. We're not going down. This is the United States. No.
Stanley Crouch.
Because it's just like the fact that Essence has started this campaign of Take the Music Back, and you're finally and those black women at Spelman. Refused to let Nelly appear on the campus last year. These are the beginnings of responses to this narrowness. And I think we're going to see an increasing awareness from people, and we're going to hear the voice of the people more and more over the next couple of years.
With that, we're out of time. Stanley Crouch, author of the new book, The Artificial White Man, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Good to have you. In a moment, another columnist on the federal dime. This is On Point. Conservative marriage researcher, syndicated columnist, and occasional on-point guest, Maggie Gallagher, finds herself in a whirlwind of controversy this week after a Washington Post report disclosed that she was paid to do work for the federal government. In 2002, Gallagher was paid more than $21,000 to draft a magazine article and several brochures for the Department of Health and Human Services in support of Bush administration marriage policies. She was also paid with funds from the Justice Department to write a report titled, Can Government Strengthen Marriage? Maggie Gallagher has appeared 3 times here on Point, including on the first day that gay marriage was made legal in Massachusetts, May 17, 2004, when she decried the day's developments.
Children need mothers and fathers, and marriage is critical in getting that for children. And I don't understand how we're going to raise a generation of young men to be good family men in a culture that says mothers, fathers, it doesn't matter. It's just two adults doing, making a commitment to each other. That's what marriage is about.
Gallagher says the government was paying her for her expertise, and the money had no bearing on her columns or talk show appearances. She says her only mistake was in not disclosing the payments. The National Society of Newspaper Columnists disagrees. Its president issued a statement today saying, "You cannot serve two masters. Either you are an unflinchingly independent journalist, or you are a public relations officer." The Gallagher controversy follows last month's revelation that conservative commentator Armstrong Williams was paid more than $240,000 to push President Bush's No Child Left Behind initiative. Maggie Gallagher joins me now. Maggie, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Not a fun week for you, but in a way not for us either. We've had you on the show several times, and you've been a staunch defender of traditional marriage, an opponent of gay marriage. And through all that, we assumed you were kind of giving it to us straight from the heart, straight out of your experience.
And why do you not assume that now?
Well, you made 40,000 plus. No, not the Washington Post. You made $40,000 from the federal government.
The Washington Post published it. You know, you just did a whole, I have to say, your whole introduction. I disagree with it factually, and I think you should give me a chance to respond.
I'm happy to give you a fact.
The made in the Washington Post that you have just retailed is that I was paid by the Bush administration to promote administration policy. It is simply not true. It's completely, I mean, to me, that's about the worst thing you could say about me. And it's not true. The reality is I'm a marriage expert. I've spent 20 years of my life doing research and public education on marriage. And it's not unusual for the government to ask experts to do things within their field of expertise. I doubt you could find a scholar who's written for the New York Times or the Washington Post about something that they're an expert on, who has not at some time taken government funds for some kind of research project. And it is not ever. This is an entirely new ethical standard that says, oh, somehow you're on the take if you get paid to do honest work in your field of expertise. And anyone who does that is not allowed to write for a newspaper ever again. If that's the standard, it's an entirely new ethical standard. It has no relationship to any other way the world works. And the reason this is a story is only because Armstrong Williams apparently, and I don't know, have no firsthand knowledge, but apparently he took money in a contract to promote Bush policies in his column.
I don't think that's an apparent matter. He's confirmed that that's the case.
I'm not challenging it. I'm just saying I haven't followed the story closely enough to know, to say from a fact, my firsthand knowledge that it's true. And therefore, the goal is to get to a story where we can now say that several journalists have been paid by the Bush administration to promote its policies.
So you are not willing to consider this on the merits at all. You're saying this is an attack by the media upon your integrity, period?
I'm saying exactly what I said when Howard Kurtz got off the phone and I said, and he asked me, he didn't ask me, by the way, he's the media ethics czar. Did he ask me, I'm going to publish the charge that you were paid to promote Bush marriage policies. What's your response? And print that? No. He just called me up and said, I heard you did some work for HHS and you didn't, and that you didn't disclose it. Do you think that you ought to have disclosed it? And I got off the phone and 10 minutes later, I thought about it for 10 minutes and I said, I think he's right. I think I should have mentioned it. These things had no connection. I have written about marriage and about I wrote in 1996 a book about the importance of using law and public policy to promote marriage. And when I wrote another column about marriage, which was probably my 100th column about the importance of marriage, there was just no connection in my mind. But when it was raised, I think the answer to should you have disclosed is always yes. Which is that because I did legitimate work in my field of expertise for HHS, I am somehow not an independent journalist, and that my credibility as an opinion columnist is to be called into question, and that I was paid by the Bush administration like Armstrong Williams. That's what you just said and repeated.
None of those things are true. It's the president of the National...
True.
Maggie Gallagher, it's not true what you just stated. The National Society of Newspaper Columnists is the one who said you cannot serve two masters.
On your show, you've just simply retailed that. Okay.
Yes, I'm reporting exactly what the National Society of Newspaper Columnists says,
fine.
And they say you cannot serve two masters. If there was no connection,
reacting to it equally strongly.
If there was no connection between your work and the federal contracts and the federal government's position, then why should you have disclosed it?
Because if the answer is, would any of your readers be interested in the fact, the answer is always, yes, you should disclose it. There's never a good reason not to disclose it. And if anyone, and the reason I said yes, and I went before Howard Kurtz filed his story, I filed my syndicated column in which I laid out the facts and apologized for that, for the, on the question of disclosure, is exactly, you know, if anyone had, I sat down and I said to myself, you know, okay, I don't know if this is good or bad for me, or any, but if somebody had said to me, Maggie, do you remember that you did some work for HHS and do you think you should disclose it? I would have said, yeah, that's a good idea, and I would have done it.
Maggie Gallagher, we've had you on a number of times, and we've heard you with all apparent seriousness, and I don't doubt it, defend traditional marriage. But can you see how readers or listeners may subsequently look back at your work on marriage for an administration that has a very particular policy, writing brochures for them, writing magazine articles for them, might listen back and say, you know, was that the real deal or were we getting jobbed here?
No, I don't think that that's any reason for anyone who knows anything about my work or my policies, as I said, which is a 20-year history of research, public education, and advocacy. This is what I do most of my time. I'm like, you know, Gary Wills is a historian, and then he also writes a newspaper column. I spend 90% of my time on research and public education on marriage. I've written two books. You know, I've written numerous scholarly articles. I attend conferences, academics and intellectual. I, you know, advise public officials on this issue. This is a, it, because I feel so strongly, as your clip indicated, about these 24 million fatherless children. And I got into this when I became an unwed mother in 1982. Just shortly thereafter, that is what launched me into this work.
Maggie Gallagher is the president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy and a syndicated columnist. She spoke with me earlier today. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie joins me now. Jack, there is a woman in a tough spot. The sort of public media allergy right now for the even appearance of someone who was paid to shill for the government in the role of press representative, that allergy is very high. Maggie Gallagher says, hey, wait a minute, the rules are changing on me. I did nothing wrong.
Well, she did. She should have told her readers. She should have told our listeners. And she should have told the Senate. She testified before the Senate. And I think there's going to be an investigation, or at least some people are calling for that, because the Senate has rules about that. They were interviewing her as if she were a complete independent analyst. And she's not. That's a conflict of interest. That's just a basic rule of journalism. And it's not the end of this, I'm afraid. Tony Blankley, the conservative columnist, says, my suspicion is it'll only be a very few people, but maybe I'm being naive. He's referring to the Freedom of Information Act suits that are out there, looking into other conservative journalists. Cal Thomas says all conservative pundits now are under a cloud, and they are under a cloud.
It's ironic, though, because, you know, having listened to Maggie Gallagher in those appearances, I don't really doubt her sincerity. I don't doubt that she's genuinely supporting traditional marriage.
No, there's no question but that she had the longstanding view, but it's a qualitatively different matter when you take the king's shilling. And she did, and didn't tell her readers, and that, you know, that should be a fireable offense, in my view, from her column.
But what about her point that so much of America, one way or another, in the kind of pundit part of America has, or research part of America has, connections to federal dollars?
Yeah, but taking a research grant, say from the NIH, is a very different matter from writing a brochure or a letter or an article under ghostwriting for a government agency. There's a qualitative difference there. In the one case, your disinterested scholarship is hired. In the other, you're kind of working for the administration. And something happened just the other day at the press conference. There's a fellow named Jeff Gannon, who's self-described. He works for the Talon News Service. He's famous for asking Bush softball questions, and he asked him another one. And it turns out this guy's a member of the Texas Christian Coalition. He's won a commendation from the Texas Republican Party.
That's not a crime.
Not a crime, but he's notorious for asking these softball questions that Bush answers and they get off on. And, you know, he gets his moment.
Well, the allergies are up. Jack, we're out of time. Thanks for being with us tonight. What a world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.